Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael J. Wilson of the group Maryland Hunger Solutions, who explains why federal budget cuts to SNAP, the nation's food stamp program, will hurt children, seniors, and the disabled most. Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who assesses recent court challenges to a controversial Texas anti-abortion law and the impact the measure will have on women's health care across the state. And author and activist Norman Solomon, who discusses the campaign to restore former NSA contractor-turned-whistleblower Edward Snowden's U.S. passport. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a reversal of fortune for M23 rebels in eastern Congo, the Army of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with the backing of the United Nations, has routed the guerrilla force, who a year earlier controlled strategic cities including Goma on the border with Rwanda. M23 was founded in April 2012 after 300 soldiers, most of them former members of the National Congress for the Defense of the People rebel group that had integrated into the Congolese National Army, rebelled due to poor conditions and the government's failure to implement a March 2009 peace agreement. The rebel group has reportedly been supported by the Rwandan government. After a recent round of peace talks in Uganda, fighting broke out between the reorganized Congolese army and the M23 rebels. The army regained lost ground and pushed rebel fighters beyond the border town of Bunagana into neighboring Rwanda. The rout is significant since it is the first time in 20 years Congo's army has successfully executed a major offensive against the rebellion in the eastern part of the country. Rich deposits of rare minerals that are used to manufacture cell phones, computers, and other electronics are mined there. Now, after the U.S. and European Union pressured Rwanda to stop providing military aid to M23, the rebel group declared an end to its insurgency on November 5th and said it was ready to negotiate a political solution. Former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, now U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa, is hopeful that negotiations on amnesty and reintegration of the rebels into Congo's army will be part of a future peace accord. Since 1998, the International Rescue Committee estimates that 5,400,000 people have died in Congo from war-related causes, the world's deadliest documented conflict since World War II. In 2010, Colombian farmer Sofridi Culma began the legal process to reclaim his lost plot of land. The threats came almost immediately with the message that right-wing paramilitary groups would target him for retaliation. Since 1991, 23,000 square miles of land have been stolen or abandoned, with much of it ending up in the hands of national or multinational agribusiness and mining companies, former or current combatants, and farmers allied with armed groups. Some observers have labeled this massive theft of land as reverse land reform. The loss of land has been one of the many consequences of Colombia's decades-long civil war, which has claimed over 220,000 lives and forced 5 million people to flee their homes. Human Rights Watch has documented 17 cases of murders of land claimants since 2008, in which 21 people have been killed while attempting to reclaim their land. According to the Guardian newspaper, 52% of rural land in Colombia is controlled by 1.5% of landowners, a driving force of economic inequality, poverty, and conflict. Land reform is a key issue being negotiated in current peace talks between the Colombian government and FARC rebels in Havana, Cuba. Progressive U.S. senators, including Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren, celebrated when President Obama nominated Janet Yellen to become the next chair of the Federal Reserve Board, as controversial White House insider Larry Summers withdrew his name. But as Wall Street lobbyists moved to dilute the already weak Dodd-Frank banking reform law, Warren and Ohio Senate Democrat Sherrod Brown sought out Republican allies to push forward on financial regulation. While implementation of the 2010 Dodd-Frank banking law has been delayed by Wall Street lobbyists, big banks continue to consolidate their power, growing four times larger than before the 2008 financial crisis. according to the news magazine In These Times, the top six banks now have assets equal to 65% of the U.S. economy. To revive banking reform, in April, Senator Brown co-sponsored a bill with Louisiana GOP Senator David Vitter to raise bank capital standards, increasing the amount of money banks must set aside to address future financial crises. Brown also reintroduced the Safe Banking Act, which requires big banks to spin off or sell assets when their value grows over $600 billion. Warren has teamed up with Arizona Republican John McCain to reintroduce the Glass-Steagall Act to put a barrier between consumer deposits and more risky investment banking. While these bills aren't likely to pass, their introduction and public debate has had the effect of pressuring regulators to get tough with big banks and the financial services industry, actions popular with a broad spectrum of the public. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, that distributes federal food stamps, suffered $5 billion in cuts on November 1st, when a post-economic meltdown stimulus boost in funding expired. Nationally, about 47 million people who receive food stamps will see reductions in their monthly food subsidy. For an average family of three, the impact of the food stamp program's first across-the-board cut in its history will result in $29 less each month, allotting $1.81 per meal, adding up to a loss of funds to buy 16 meals. 49% of food stamp recipients are children, and 87% of households that receive SNAP benefits are home to children, seniors, or the disabled. Beyond the immediate impact on the nation's poor, the ripple effect of the funding cutback will be felt by local retailers like grocery stores. It's estimated that every $1 spent in food stamps generates $1.70 in economic activity in the communities where the funds are spent. What worries many anti-poverty activists more than the recent loss of $5 billion is the specter of new, deeper cuts to SNAP. The Republican-controlled House has voted to slash the SNAP program by $39 billion over the next 10 years, while the Democratically-controlled Senate has proposed $4.5 billion in funding reductions in the next decade. House and Senate conferees must now negotiate a compromise position on the SNAP budget, one that is likely to leave more Americans hungry. Your reporter spoke with Michael J. Wilson of the group Maryland Hunger Solutions, who explains why federal budget cuts to the food stamp program will hurt children, seniors, and the disabled most.
The good thing about food stamps is that it works the way it's supposed to work. When the economy is bad, food stamp use is high, and more people use the program. And then as the economy recovers, fewer people use it, and the use goes down. The problem with the Era Boost was that it was seen as temporary because everyone thought that 4 years later the economy would have been better. In fact, it's gotten somewhat better, but it's been such a lagging economy that there's still high unemployment, high joblessness, and even a lot of the folks who are on food stamps, who utilize food stamps, are working part-time and don't have enough hours or income to be able to cover all the basic expenses that they're faced with. And so when we, both FRAC and Maryland Hunger Solutions and other anti-hunger groups around the country, called on the Congress to restore that and make sure that the boost did not go down, it pretty much fell on deaf ears, unfortunately. It got lost in all the other conversation about the budget, about the cost, about things that were going on, when we know, in fact, that the economy has not recovered enough for most folks to be able to really be able to move on and get jobs and get income in a very, very, very difficult economy.
Michael, what will be the effect of this $5 billion cut to the SNAP program, the food stamp program, for an average family who depends in large part on the supplement that food stamps provide?
So there'll be a lot of impacts. So first of all, the amount of the cut is about 5.5%. So for a single family household, that might be as much as $11 a month. for two people in a household as much as $20 a month. It's going to vary depending on your expenses, your deductions, your income, if you have income, and all of those things. So those are average numbers that I would give you. But just take that average number, an $11 a month cut in food stamps for someone who doesn't get very much is still, you know, a significant amount. As it is, people who are often on food stamps now often find themselves not having enough income and food stamps to last through the entire month, and that's why they end up going to food banks and to churches and synagogues and other places that can help provide additional sustenance for folks in a really difficult situation. The other part of this is that it's going to have a drag on the economy when people can't spend that same amount on food. That's $5 billion that's going to be taken out of the economy, that won't be spent in grocery stores and local stores and farmers markets and other places. It's just not going to get spent, and that does not help the economy, whether locally there in Connecticut, here in Maryland, or anywhere around the country. That's just an additional drag on the economy. And the last part of that is that this is a cut that's coming in the midst of a conversation about even broader and deeper cuts that the Congress is considering, which is just going to make things even worse.
Beyond this $5 billion in cuts to the SNAP program, there are deeper cuts in the offing, with the Republican-controlled House proposing $39 billion in further cuts to food stamps over the next 10 years. And then the Senate, controlled by the Democrats, proposes a lesser $4.5 billion in cuts over the next decade. Tell us what your big concern here is and how the negotiations between the House and Senate are going to come out, and what's going to be the likely impact for the poor and working poor who depend on food stamps.
The first reaction I have is that this is no time to be cutting SNAP. With unemployment still being very high, with people having low wages, with people having not enough hours, it's the gap between those who have and those who have not that is growing. And so food stamps, as I repeat, are working the way they're supposed to work now. There's a high cost and there's high usage because the economy is in a bad shape. The second thing is the cuts that you described, $4.5 billion in the Senate, and that was not supported by all Democrats, by the way, and the $39 billion in the House, which was not supported by any Democrats. It was only Republican votes that did that, is a disaster waiting to happen. Already we've seen the cuts that happened last week. Just to give you an easy number to remember, if you take all of the food done by all the food banks and all the churches all around the country, it's about $1 billion in a year. And so the $39 billion cuts, which is roughly $40 billion, which is roughly $4 billion a year, if every food bank and every church doubled what they could do and then doubled it again, they can make up for this difference. But they can't. And they know they can't, and they've said they can't. They've said it to the public. They've said it to the Congress. They've said it to us. They say it all the time. That's not an amount that they can make up. And so there is nothing that can make up for taking that much food sustenance out of the economy that isn't going to hurt people. And the majority of folks who are on food stamps, the vast majority are either families with kids, they are disabled folks, and they are elderly people.
That was Michael J. Wilson of the group Maryland Hunger Solutions, an initiative of the Food Research and Action Center. For more analysis on the impact of food stamp cuts, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the most recent legislative session in Texas, there was a serious fight over an omnibus anti-abortion bill that included many restrictions that would make it almost impossible for many women in the state to get an abortion. Despite protests by thousands of Texans supporting pro-choice legislators like State Senator Wendy Davis, the bill passed in a special session and was signed into law by GOP Governor Rick Perry. Two of the provisions were challenged in court by Planned Parenthood and other groups. One measure in the law requires that doctors performing abortions get admitting privileges at a local hospital. Another measure mandates doctors use an outdated protocol when performing drug-induced abortions with RU486, the so-called abortion pill. Initially, federal district court Judge Lee Yackel struck down the admitting privileges requirement as unconstitutional and partially struck down the medication protocol. But then last week, a three-judge panel at the appeals court level, all women judges appointed by President George W. Bush, overturned the lower court ruling and permitted the controversial Texas law to go into effect. Now Planned Parenthood and other pro-choice groups have appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate the earlier injunction blocking portions of the law concerning doctors' admitting privileges. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Director of State Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. Here she talks about what happens next in Texas and also provides an overview of the many anti-abortion laws across the country and her group's efforts to challenge them.
And so that was a good outcome from the district court. And the state immediately appealed that decision to the appellate court, to the next court up. And a very hostile anti-choice judge, unfortunately, was the judge who was reviewing this, part of the panel that was reviewing this. And so they rejected the district court's decision and said that the law could go into effect. And what it means is that basically one in three Texas women will no longer have access to safe abortion services in the state of Texas. And we just heard this morning that Planned Parenthood has petitioned, sent an emergency petition to the Supreme Court to try and stop that law going into effect again.
So an abortion doctor needing admitting privileges does sort of make sense on the face of it. But any woman needing emergency care would be admitted to a nearby hospital in any case, right?
That's right. If a woman had a complication, and I should underscore how rare that is, abortion is a very safe procedure, but if a woman were to have a complication and needed to go to an emergency room, she would get cared for. Hospitals have to take patients who are having an emergency and they have to care for them. And that is appropriate. We want those women to get care. The problem is that these kinds of requirements are extremely difficult for a provider, especially one who doesn't need to use the emergency room often, to meet. So they may require that doctors meet a certain number of admittances, and an abortion provider, again, who has safe procedures and doesn't have to admit women, wouldn't be able to meet those. And we also know that there are a lot of Catholic hospitals who won't grant a provider admitting privileges if that provider performs abortions. So we've seen this come up in a number of other states, including in Mississippi, which only has one abortion clinic, and we know that every single provider who works for that clinic was denied admitting privileges at every hospital to which they applied. So it really is a backdoor ban on abortion. It's a way for politicians to drive abortion providers out of practice.
Gretchen Borschelt, are you aware of any documented cases where women have either tried to self-abort or maybe had major medical problems or even died due to lack of access to abortion care?
Well, we've heard some stories actually in Texas, which, as we know, is already challenging because of the geography there, of women who, when they aren't able to access abortion from a provider who's doing it safely and legally. We've heard stories of women crossing the border into Mexico and getting drugs and taking them without medical supervision and oversight and some very serious consequences to their health. And there may have even been a case where a woman died. So certainly based on this decision in Texas and the fact that one-third of abortion providers are going to have to stop performing abortions if this law goes into effect, we're very concerned about the women there turning to these unsafe measures.
There are similar attacks on women's reproductive rights going on in many other states. Can you tell us where these restrictions have gone into effect and where they're still in litigation and have not gone into effect?
We've kind of seen this tidal wave of abortion restrictions in the states this year. And in the beginning of the legislative session, we saw a lot of these outright attacks on abortion, just extreme abortion measures where they're just trying to ban abortion outright. And so North Dakota was one of those states that banned abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy. Arkansas also banned abortion at 12 weeks of pregnancy, very, very early in women's pregnancy. 6 weeks, as you said, is obviously before most women know they're pregnant. Both of those have been struck down. And I think that when we see those kind of blatant attempts to overturn Roe versus Wade and a woman's constitutional right to abortion, we've seen judges say, no, you've gone too far. What's more worrisome is that these other kinds of restrictions, these restrictions on abortion providers, these interferences with the doctor-patient relationship, these are working their way through the courts in a lot of states, and we're seeing decisions come out different ways. And so the regulations that are targeting abortion providers, the ones that force providers to have a hallway of a certain size or make sure that there's a water fountain in the waiting room, which are just medically unnecessary and very burdensome to providers and force them to shut down, those have been upheld in some states. And so we now have 28 states that have some kind of requirement on providers that is more than what is medically necessary. Now, I will say that Texas so far is an outlier in this admitting privileges fight. I mentioned earlier Mississippi has this kind of requirement, and it's not the only one that's passed it in the last few years. So Alabama, Mississippi, North Dakota, and Wisconsin all passed these kinds of requirements that are meant to drive abortion providers out of practice. And in those four states, they have been challenged and blocked so far. But there are a couple other states where they're in effect. So what we have right now is really a patchwork across the country where it seems to be that a woman's constitutional right to abortion depends on where she lives. And that's certainly not the promise of our Constitution and the way that we understand rights to exist. So we're very, very concerned about that.
That was Gretchen Borscheldt, Director of State Reproductive Health Policy at the National Women's Law Center. For more analysis and commentary on the ongoing battle over reproductive rights, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The latest revelations from documents collected by former NSA contractor turned whistleblower Edward Snowden include allegations that the U.S. National Security Agency had conducted surveillance on millions of Europeans in France, Germany, and Spain, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone. While not denying the monitoring of Chancellor Merkel's mobile phone, the director of the NSA, General Keith Alexander, denied that the U.S. had conducted surveillance in Europe. He instead maintained at a recent congressional hearing that records of European phone and internet communication had been provided to the U.S. by allied intelligence agencies. That claim was supported by documents leaked by Snowden that spy agencies in Germany, France, Spain, Sweden, and the Netherlands had been developing surveillance capabilities in cooperation with Great Britain. As the public in many European nations are demanding answers, Hans Christian Strobel, a member of the German parliament, traveled to Moscow on October 31st to meet with Edward Snowden, who has resided there since Russia granted him temporary asylum in August. Strobel and George Moscolo, a former editor-in-chief with Der Spiegel magazine, discussed the possibility of arranging for Mr. Snowden to testify before a German parliamentary committee hearing on the details of NSA surveillance in Europe. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, author, activist, and co-founder of the group RootsAction.org. Here, Solomon discusses the significance of the latest NSA surveillance revelations and the campaign his group is organizing to restore Edward Snowden's U.S. passport.
Really, the information in recent days has underscored just how global the surveillance is, the assumption and the technical capacity that the NSA has to see the entire world and literally all of its inhabitants, anybody with a cell phone able to send a text, able to use email, able to use a telephone, that they're all fair game. That, in fact, the NSA of the United States views the entire planet as a wiretappable, surveillanceable entity. And so it sort of stands to reason when you step back from it that the same agency for the same government that has a sense of mission to be able to monitor all communications and has the technical capacity more than any other government in the world, would not stop short of listening in on the phone calls of the head of the government of Germany or Brazil or, you know, all over the world, government leaders. Why exclude them when you have millions and millions of emails and phone calls being monitored in a number, many, many different countries every day quite intensively.
Norman, your group, RootsAction.org, has taken up a petition to restore Edward Snowden's U.S. passport that was taken away. Maybe you could speak to what the objective of this campaign is and what would be the significance an aid to public disclosure and public information about surveillance if Edward Snowden did receive his passport back.
Yes, the passport that was revoked is a right that he has, and it should be restored. And it was revoked by the U.S. Department of State. So the petition is directed to Secretary of State John Kerry. And as we speak, 45,000 people have signed the petition. Anybody listening can join them by going to rootsaction.org. Another way to go there is supportedwardsnowden.org. Either way, you can get to the petition. And I think the significance includes that the right to travel is essential to one's rights as a citizen. You know, back decades ago during the Cold War, the Kremlin was often criticized out of Washington for restricting and forbidding travel of some of its citizens. And there was a case that was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1981 in the instance of Philip Agee, the former CIA agent who had blown the whistle on so many crimes by the CIA. And it was a bad decision. It was 7-2. But one of the dissenters wrote an eloquent decision, William Brennan, and he said that the right to travel should exist for popular and unpopular travelers, just as the right to free speech should be given to not only those who are exercising their right to free speech with popular speech, but also to those who are engaged in unpopular speech. And so I think it's profoundly important that we put up this fight. Clearly, the Obama administration doesn't want to give the passport back, to put it mildly, but rather than simply accept the idea that it's okay to or acceptable for the government to take a passport away from somebody who they don't like, we should fight on this issue and fight on.
That was Norman Solomon, a former California congressional candidate, co-founder of RootsAction.org, and author of the book War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Find links to Solomon's recent articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.